is now in session. Judge Ross, Chief Judge Siegel, and Judge Smith, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Court of Appeals for this November 4, 2021 panel of oral arguments. I say welcome, actually, I'm not really welcoming you to the court. Welcome to wherever you are in this Zoom proceeding. So that our oral recording captures it, we are not appearing live in the Judicial Center today, but we're hosting this oral argument by Zoom. And the party should be aware that even though we can see each other and we can identify each other by name on our screen, we're only making an audio recording, not a video recording of the proceedings today for posting on our website for the public. And that means you should continue to follow our usual approach of stating your name as you commence each leg of your oral argument today. Each side will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes for relator for rebuttal. I believe we have multiple counsel represented here for respondents. So I will ask whether there's an intention to have multiple arguments or you'll have a single argument for respondents.
There is, Your Honor. Jay Squire is appearing for Aiken County. I will take 6 of the 15 minutes, and Mr. Hansen on behalf of Norseman Club will take 9 of the 15 minutes.
All right. Now we can do this in one of two ways. We can either have the marshal designate specified time in the clock, or just allow the 15 minute clock to run and leave it to you all to step off and allow your co-counsel or aligned counsel to begin the argument. Which is your preference?
I think if it's possible to have individual clocks, it might be less confusing for us, and I'll know that my time's coming to an end rather than do the math.
All right, we'll do that, and that'll avoid any controversy. Wouldn't want to have this come to you guys come to blows if you eat into somebody else's time. So I'll just state for the record that the first matter on our oral argument calendar today is the application number 2020-6782, conditional use permit. Counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready to proceed, you may.
It pleases the court. We're here today to determine whether this court should reverse or at least modify the conditional use permit granted by the Aiken County Planning Commission to respondent Norseman, where the Planning Commission seemingly ignored its own procedural requirements when granting the permit, disregarded actual expert data and overwhelming public input against granting the permit, and disregarded serious mental health issues of a local resident very near the Norseman's operation. Standard of review here is fairly well known. The local governments and county agencies get differential treatment by the courts and based on their assumed expert knowledge in the areas. There's several cases you can cite there, but one I've cited is Big Lake Association and St. Louis County Planning Committee, 761 Northwest 2nd, 487, Minnesota, 2009. However, the scope of review is not boundless, and Minnesota case law has put some definition around where we might find arbitrary and capricious behavior. And a couple of cases I want to cite right out of the chute is that you can overturn the case when there is no reasoned determination of how the agency arrived at its decision. Builders Association of Twin Cities versus Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry, 872 Northwest 2nd, 263 Minnesota Court Ave, 215. I think the more relevant one to this case, in fact, the overriding standard review in this case, is where can modify or reverse when there's a combination of danger signals which suggest the agency has not taken a hard look at the salient problems. The decision lacks articulated standards and reflect the findings. You find that in Cable Communications Board versus Norwest Cable, 536 Northwest 2nd, 658. page 669, Minnesota 1984. And that really frames up the entire argument for realtors. The justification for overruling the Aiken County Planning Commission started very early in the process. Section 3.11 of the Aiken County Ordinance defines conditional use. Conditional use means a land use or development as defined by the ordinance that would not be appropriate generally, but may be allowed with appropriate restrictions. The key word there, phrase there, is land use as defined by the ordinances. The land use, conditional uses, are then defined in Appendix A, which a very comprehensive appendix, and literally states every conditional use allowed in every zoning.
Mr. Anderson, if I might interject here just for a moment, you already mentioned Big Lake. So what difference does it make that it's not a listed use in Appendix A? Because this was an open zoning classification, correct? And you're not claiming that this is a not permitted use. Are you? Yeah.
No.
So what difference does it make? Why should we reverse?
Well, let me begin by saying that the conditional use is in an open place, but there's still no conditional use defined for that open place that includes what they have requested. That's number one. Number two, that process then leads to another process. So if it's not stated in the actual Exhibit A as a conditioned use, then what's supposed to happen is that there's supposed to be an application filed with the Board of Adjustment to determine sort of what has to happen after that. And in this case, Your Honor, nothing happened. I mean, there was no reference to the Board of Adjustment. And so our position is that the realtors were not given the proper process that was supposed to happen in that hearing. Now, the respondents argue that the failure to follow their own procedures is not reason to modify or reverse the decision, based primarily on three arguments. The first one is that there is a waived right of bringing up a matter that was not presented in the process itself. And there is case law on that, and there's no doubt about that. However, in Big Lake itself, the court state, the issue does not need to be framed in precise legal terms, but there must be sufficient specificity to provide fair notice of the nature of the challenge so that the zoning authority has an opportunity to consider and address the issue. So the standard there is, did the commission have an opportunity to consider and address the issue? Our position is that they did. Respondent themselves even mentioned one such notice on page 16 of their brief, when they noted that realtor Sandy and Craig Schultz, in a letter dated September 27, 2019, argued that a cup was required for the club's proposed use of the land. Now, a cup required for the proposed use of the land implies that the cup application includes following the process. So from our standpoint, that is sufficient notice to consider consider what has to be considered. Now that might not make sense if that was a private party or whatever, but the board actually did not follow their own process, which they should have known. So once the cup came up as a way of getting the application started, they should have been able to figure out that the entire process would be included, and that our view is adequate notice. Your Honor, I couldn't find a case like this. There are cases that talk about how to get rid of that waiver, but this is unique. I haven't found a case that said if you don't use an appendix that defines what a conditional use is, then you're out of luck.
So if this had, if the application had been made to the Board of Adjustment, what decision points would have been in front of them? What do you anticipate would have happened? I'm just trying to figure out the impact of all this.
Understood, Your Honor. Unfortunately, Appendix A is a little light on what happens afterwards. They are supposed to figure out how they would classify this actual request. And I think respondent in one of their reasons for not having to have the board review it indicates that, well, if the board had reviewed it, I think it's on page 16, if the board had actually had a chance to review it, they would have sided with it anyway. They would have allowed it as a conditional use. Now, we don't know that. And my response to that would be, well, then that's fine. Then give us a finding and the rationale you're looking for, Your Honor. But they didn't do that. We don't have a very clear cut answer to what happens after that within the terms of their process. That answer your question, I'm sorry.
Yes, yeah, yep. Thank you.
So the other point that the respondent makes is that it's on page 19 of Norseman's brief, argue that the adjustment may have been involved early on, but the record simply doesn't show it because it was so early. And in fact, didn't cover it because there wasn't a request for such. And again, if that's the case, then we could simply also assume, as opposed to assume that they looked at it and decided it was all right, they could have looked at it and decided that this hidden review found that the Board of Adjustment stated the use could not be allowed. So it's not really an argument that it could have happened. It's not an argument that it did. And finally, and even more important to this case, I think, is the respondent saying that it was up to the relators to actually file the request for review by the board. And I just want to point out that that I haven't found any case law that says that is the case, but it's even more sort of obvious from a straightforward analysis. Look, the application process is spelled out in paragraph 11 of the zoning ordinance, and it walks through what forms have to be used and those types of things. And it ends with Appendix A saying, and oh, by the way, if there is no use that is associated with the conditional use, then the application has to be filed. To the realtors, there is a clear, pretty clear picture that would make a lot of sense that in an application process, the applicant should be filing for that, and the agency should be looking for that, putting the burden on the folks who are appealing and saying and opposing doesn't make a great deal of sense. They can simply oppose it, and I would expect that the agency would follow their own rules. But
Mr. Anderson,
yes,
we have the sufficient briefing, I suppose, on the collateral matter of the motion to strike, but you can, if you'd like to, say anything about that motion, which is pending before us. And we'll invite your opponents to do the same if they choose to during their oral argument.
No, Your Honor, I think I'll just let my memo stand. There's a rule in place, and we've applied for that. We've applied with Erica Zimmerman to record herself as standing in the stead of her husband, Prime. And I think that's all I have to say in that matter.
All right.
We want to go to page 93 of the record, where it shows the findings that have been implemented to grant this conditional use permit. Now, the courts have held that a checklist approach to findings is okay, and respondents properly cite Swartz's case for that particular holding. However, there is a factual distinction here with Swartz and the others. Here, I'll walk through quickly you can see a bunch of findings, just yes, 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 yes. Very little other interesting tidbits about what we expected. And here, I want to put the onus on paragraph 4. The proposed use conforms to the comprehensive land use of the county. One note of only two. And yes, the proposed use is allowed as a conditional use permit. It's not. Proposed use wasn't a conditional use permit. That's incorrect. And there should have been more detail there under the holding in the cable case to explain why, in fact, that's true, or at least give us an argument why that's true. And I think that's as well as many of the other ones that are on that page. In particular, the location and character of the proposed use are considered to be consistent with several pattern development locality in general. There is some discussion, of course, in the record, the master record, but these findings are such a checklist that we don't know really what they ruled on. I do know one thing, that they seem to combine the idea that the property itself isn't going to be changed. They're still going to have the same tracks that they had there. But they don't focus on the use that those tracks are now going to be used for vehicles and the weekend they're going to be loud and probably obnoxious. In the last 41 seconds, Your Honor, I just want to also point to pages 400 through 423, where the rest of the reasons that haven't been articulated very well in the findings are stated very well by my client, Craig Schultz. And it's a checklist of all the reasons we think there are danger signs throughout this process. There's noise test conflicts. There is treatment of my client Brian, and there's a lot of other stuff in there. Maybe I'll get a chance to get to that.
Thank you. You will have 5 minutes of rebuttal time if you'd like to use it. Counsel for respondent, which of you is going first, and how much time? Are you the 6 minute or the 9 minute?
I will, Your Honor. I'm the 6 minuter.
6 minuter. All right. You may proceed, state your name and the party you represent, and begin your argument.
Thank you. Jay Squires representing Aiken County in this case. I will address Roman numeral one in the relator's brief, which is the argument that the county could not have issued a CUP and this court should reverse because a CUP was not a possibility under the ordinance. Mr. Hansen will address Roman numeral two in relator's brief, which is a discussion of what Mr. Anderson called the combination of warning signals that this court should note. Just a correction that Mr. Anderson was critiquing the findings of fact at the end of his argument, referencing administrative record. I think he said page 92 or something like that. That's the wrong set of findings. That's related to a different matter. There were a number of CUPs issued on February 22nd of that year. The court should refer to page 66 of the administrative record, which are the findings for this particular case. So the critiques of the inadequate findings on page 92 are a bit in opposite to our issue. But going into the issue of whether the Norseman use of the property doesn't even qualify for a conditional use permit under the ordinance, that argument has been waived. And we cite the pertinent case. It's a Thiel v. Stitch issue. In 1999, this court began to apply the Thiel v. Stitch concept to county land use decisions. That's the Granby-Itasca County case. That was a case I handled where, at the time, the statute that applied in that case said that variances could be granted by counties for in instances of hardship or practical difficulty. And the county denied the variance, citing no hardship. And nothing was raised by the landowner at the county proceeding. But during the court proceeding, they argued, well, the county procedurally erred because they did not consider practical difficulty as an alternate argument. Court said, no, you have to raise that issue before the county. That issue is waived. Then kind of moving fast forward to 2009 to the Big Lake case, which we discuss in our materials, the court continued to affirm the waiver concept and the impropriety of property owners sandbagging a county. In that particular case, the county processed a land use request as a commercial planned unit development. Landowners opposed it, offered their substantive objections to it. The CUP or the permit was granted, was challenged to the court, and they added the additional argument that the court saying this was improperly processed because the county should have processed it as a residential PUD, which would have changed the playing field on a number of different fronts that aren't pertinent here. The Supreme Court looked at that and said, no, that's a waiver. They looked at the record. The landowner, like Mr. Anderson argues in this case, argued, well, the fact that my clients were generally opposed to the application is enough to put the county on notice. And the court rejected, as this court should reject in this case, that general opposition as actually raising the issue before the county. I think one of you judges, I think it was you, Judge Segal, asked what would have happened. And in Big Lake, the county pointed out, as I would point out in this case, that, well, if you had properly raised the issue, in this case, if the relators had said, we don't think you can even grant a CUP under your ordinance, then it could have been dealt with by the county and a proper record could have been created for purposes of that particular issue. And it wasn't because the issue was never raised. In fact, I've been involved in cases where issues have not been raised, where issues have been sandbagged and then later brought up in court proceedings. But this is the only case I've ever been involved in where we're actually confronted with the opposite position. So not only did they not say anything about the issue or raise the issue, but counsel for relators at the time, it wasn't Mr. Anderson, but counsel for relators actually took the opposite position with the county and said this is a use that requires a CUP.
Yeah, but if I could interject for a moment, sorry about that.
Nope, no problem.
When was the earliest that Mr. Anderson's clients knew that this was going to be some new kind of use altogether? Because if I recall, I thought the letter submitted by the Larkin law firm lawyer said this could be a racetrack or it could be, I can't remember, a club, I think. But that's not what happened in this case. So when was the first notice that Mr. Anderson's clients had that it was going to be classified as something that was not included on Appendix A?
Well, to answer your question, Mr. Anderson's clients had notice of the nature of the use in 2019, shortly after Norseman purchased the property, that they were going to be using the property to camp and to ride their motorcycles. So that's the nature of the use. They had notice of that all along. The Larkin letter is dated September 27, 2019. What happened after that, and this maybe clarifies some of the terminology questions you may have, what happened after that is an environmental assessment worksheet was done. Because in that letter, the Larkin attorney also argues that under the environmental review rules, and I see I'm already up with my time, so I'll answer the question. And then
you can complete your answer to the question.
Thank you. Under part 4410.4300 of the EQB rules, the Larkin attorney, Mr. Steen at the time, argued that an EAW was required because this also fit the definition of off-highway vehicle recreation area. So an EAW was done, and then after the negative EIS determination was made by the county, then they proceeded with the land use approval process. In the CUP, they inserted that same terminology because that is how the EAW was done. But I would say to the court, arose by any other name as arose, the use is the use. They argued that the use by Norseman was a combination of a club and a racetrack, and the CUP was processed accordingly. So thank you.
Turns to the other respondent, I believe Mr. Hansen, if you could state your full name and party you represent and commission.
Good morning, Eric Hansen on behalf of Norseman Motorcycle Club Incorporated. And as Mr. Squire has indicated, I will be focusing my argument in response to basically Roman numeral two of the petitioner's briefing. But I'm happy to delve further into other areas if the court has questions. Ultimately, the section two of the petitioner's brief really boils down to a request on the part of the petitioners that this court substitute its judgment for that of the Planning Commission. And so I think that it is appropriate that we talk about briefly what's the standard review here. And Mr. Anderson cited to the cable case, and as we indicated in our brief, I believe Aiken County did as well, that's really not the standard we're looking at here. The question really boils down to, did the commission fail to apply its regulations to the application, and was there evidence in the record to support its findings of fact? And as we go through each of the complained areas, ultimately, I would submit that their argument boils down to, well, the Planning Commission believed the wrong information. And perhaps it's appropriate to start with the noise studies that was part of the argument here. Bottom line is there were multiple noise studies submitted. None of those noise studies said that the use by Norseman would result in a violation, would be excessive noise under Minnesota's regulations. And there were some disputes in the noise studies, for example, about what the background decibel level was. But the point that I think is appropriate for the court to consider here is to look at the process employed by the Planning Commission. And the Planning Commission did look at those studies, did discuss those studies. It held two public hearings on this matter. An EAW was done. It did a site visit. It received multiple public comments. The point is that the Planning Commission did what planning commissions are supposed to do in something like this, which is weigh competing interests and weigh competing amounts of evidence. And ultimately, the Planning Commission on this point and the other points, noise study specifically, weighed it and determined that that the proposed use by Norseman was not going to violate Minnesota's noise regulations, and there is ample evidence in the record to support that conclusion.
But that's not the standard. I suppose that's part of it. If you're violating the state noise standards, that would be a problem. But in addition to that, the first standard is that it's not going to be injurious to the use and enjoyment of other property in the immediate vicinity. And it seems like there's plenty of evidence from the neighbors that they think this will interfere. So can you respond to that and how that balances out?
So respectfully, I think that is a balance question. And I do believe that the noise studies do play into that. The question is there going to be excessive noise on the Norseman property such that it impairs the use and enjoyment of the adjacent properties? And I believe that that's what the noise studies set out to show, that on this point about this perceived complaint, that this was going to be very noisy and thus impinge upon the enjoyment of the relating properties. That's what the noise studies were really designed to go to. And the conclusion of the noise studies was that it was not going to be a major impairment, that there was not going to be excessive levels of noise. In addition to that, I think that weighing that is contemplated under the consideration of a CUP is reflected in the imposition of certain conditions imposed by the Planning Commission. For example, there are operational times that are set. You cannot use this property under this CUP and go out at 3 a.m. and ride around. There were timelines set. There were vegetative buffers that were required and under the CUP. There were, and the point being that this was considered, weighed by the Planning Commission, and the Planning Commission concluded that by putting some of these restrictions in, based on what was known about the noise in this particular instance, that with these restrictions, that there would not be an excessive burden on the adjacent properties. And so I believe that the record here shows that the Planning Commission carefully considered those objections, weighed the evidence that was presented by both parties, weighed the input of the parties, and made a considered judgment. And ultimately, the argument by the petitioners here is they're asking this court to reweigh that evidence. And our standard of review does not allow for that. That is not the role of the court when reviewing a county zoning determination. Moving on to a couple of the other points, public opposition. Petitioners said, well, look at all the people that oppose this, and that's a basis for denial of the CUP. Again, this is something where, they acknowledge in their briefing, public opposition is not a basis for denial of CUP. That's admitted right in there. But I think it's also worth noting for the record that the public opposition that they cite to is based on a pretty misleading petition. That petition's in the record, and it talks about the people.
Now I think you're getting into argument here. That's not appropriate. I mean, there are two sides here, and you're saying that they weighed the side. And, if you're going to go into that, then the noise study that your client put together, there were objections to that. So does that neutralize your client's noise study?
No, it doesn't neutralize the noise study. The point that I'm perhaps inarticulately making is that the commission gave, that there were objections made by both sides to all of the various points of evidence. And the commission fully heard out all of those objections, discussed them, and then drew a conclusion. And so the question on review is, did the Planning Commission weigh in on public opposition, and did they have a basis in the record for disregarding or concluding the way they did, that the public opposition wasn't a basis for denial of the CUP? And I would submit that this record shows that. And that's true with all of the elements, whether it be the alleged trespass, the pollution, the diminution of property values. This record as a whole, and I should add the PTSD issue, shows that those were considered, discussed, and weighed by the Planning Commission. And our case law says that is entitled to deference, that it is the petitioner's obligation to show that either they didn't apply one of the criterias or that there was no evidence in the record to support the conclusions that were drawn. And they simply have not met those criteria on appeal. As a consequence, their appeal should be denied.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen. Counsel for relator, any rebuttal? You'll have to unmute your microphone.
It might be a sign of something. My rebuttal is very limited. And first of all, I don't think that Mr. Squires was hinting that there was any actual sandbagging going on here. That would I didn't see that at all in the record when I took over, and it certainly wasn't our plan to do it afterwards. So I want to make that clear. Secondly,
it doesn't have to be sand. We don't have to conclude that it was sandbagging to conclude that an argument is forfeited, though, do we?
No, I just want to make sure that the record demonstrates I don't think we were sandbagging, that's all.
Sure.
Other thing that Mr. Hansen indicated was that we aren't using the proper standard for review. And I will acknowledge that the proper standard for review is always, as he stated, did they make the decision and was it based on substantial facts? The standard of review that I'm looking at actually sits on top of that and says, take a look at the whole record. And in every one of those instances, is there a pattern that would suggest that there is, they're missing some salient points and did not weigh them properly. And so I disagree with the fact that that is not the standard of review that we can use. Secondly, I think in all those the cases that are used by Mr. Squires, they are factually distinct in a couple ways. They are actually cases that involve, substantive issues rather than the agency's own procedures. And by that, I mean, there's one that said, is it a commercial or is it a residential development? One had to do with a setback issue. These are all things that actually very simply should have been dealt with in the process. Here we have a totally missed section of the ordinance that was never deployed. And the answer to that I heard, well, you know, they said it was going to be a club, they said it was going to be this, but that's not what they did. That's not at all what they did. And I know that the other report that said, well, this is basically an off-road recreation area. Yeah, but that's not what they applied for.
If you, just to make sure nothing was missed, you were, maybe it's just my computer, but you were glitching a little bit in that last sentence. If you wanted to restate it so that we hear you, I think you were frozen for just a moment.
Apologize for that. Remember what I was saying? The argument that they had notification early that it was going to be a club or it was going to be a racetrack does not answer the question of what were they applying for. If it would have been a club and had a definition imposed against the club in Appendix A, they would have known exactly what to fight for and what to fight against. If it was a track, they would have known exactly what it is. Simply saying, well, it's going to be a club or a track or it's going to be recreational use is not pointed toward the exact use in the definitions in Appendix A that they could have used and relied on to answer their opposition. And with that, I'll just conclude by saying I think that there's plenty of things here that suggest, although it was a great deal of paper and a great deal of time was involved, it seemed as though there was a lot of time that they could have used more of their own, of their judgment rather than their will. And it looks as though Mr. Hansen said, well, I think what's happening here is that we're asking the court to use their own judgment rather than the court's. I'm suggesting here that the agency was using their own will rather than their judgment. That's all I have to say.
Thank you. And thank you to all counsel for your written submissions and for your oral argument today. It's helpful to us in deciding the case. The matter is now submitted, and we will take it under advisement, issuing our opinion within the statutory period. So thank you, and have a good afternoon.